still look upon this period of economic problems as a temporary downturn in an ever upward spiral of productivity and prosperity. During the great years of abundance, the post-war years, we became accustomed every now and again to a few months of less prosperity. And we've come to assume that these moments of the downturn must end, and then that we can return to the affluence and the easy ways that we've known, that we had known heretofore. What I would like to suggest this morning is that this moment in time is not simply one of those dishes in the economic cycle where there's a slight downturn before we proceed up again. But it represents a fundamental challenge to the whole economic system, a challenge which cannot be met unless there is some fundamental restructuring and reordering of the institutions and the standards of living and the levels of expectation of all of us. If I were to pursue the metaphor of snow and valleys and skiing, I would suggest that we are not in the valley, having come down a happy, giddy slope, a fast and good run, waiting now patiently in line for the ski lift to carry us up effortlessly to some new peak, some even higher summit. But that we find ourselves in a valley that has not yet been developed by the professionals. There's no clear path ahead. We're going to have to beat our own way up the side of the mountain. And in doing so, we're going to have to break new ground. In doing so, we're going to have to work harder and sweat more and stumble more than we have for many years. And then when we emerge, if we do, we will have found that in the process we have changed, that many of our basic institutions have changed with us. What I'm suggesting to you is that the time is over when an honest congressman from Grand Rapids can have a $100,000 ski chalet in Vail. The oil sheiks will have them, and the super rich will have them. But the unique feature of prosperity in America these last 20 years or so is that the middle class has, for the most part, been able to live as if they were rich. Very little was beyond our reach. And we became accustomed to a standard of living and a standard of traveling and a standard of diet and a standard of housing which no other middle class in the history of the world has ever enjoyed. And now with this tightening of the economic scene, America no longer enjoys mastery of world power. The period is long since over when our minds control such technological knowledge as is known to the world. Cheap energy no longer can turn the machines of our society. Everything will cost more. We'll have to work harder, work more carefully. The capital invested in our second car will have to go for public transportation. We'll have to accept the socialization of many of the services that we now purchase individually, medical services, recreational services, higher education. We're going to have to be more careful in our husbanding of the resources of our nation. It's going to have to be a more equitable distribution of the wealth of the nation, higher taxes. And all of this suggests to me that much of the ease, and certainly that excited level of expectation which has been part of our lives will disappear. And that we will return to a condition, an earlier condition, of harder work, more sweat, more tears, less abundance, and less security. And I would suggest further that we will not even achieve that unless there are some fundamental changes in the economic structuring of the nation, and unless we change inside and begin to recognize that the merit of a person lies not in his net worth, but in his human worth, and in his civic worth. Until we begin to recognize that we've got to live cooperatively and patiently rather than competitively, arrogantly, impatiently. Now, there will continue to be people of great wealth around us. There'll be fewer. But the great bulk of Americans will certainly have less and work harder. And life will be far more disagreeable for us unless we learn to establish true community, to find happiness in family and in friendship, in ideas, in culture, good talk, and all the basic things about which the great religions have spoken, lo, these many centuries. I believe that we are approaching this time which will be as climactic and as important in the history of our nation as were the 1930s. We are approaching this time of institutional reconstruction and internal reconstruction at a time which is propitious in one major respect. 1974 saw Americans pass successfully through a great constitutional crisis. And we stand now at the beginning of 1975 with our freedoms unimpaired. In point of fact, our freedoms are probably more secure than they have been for some years. On August 9th of last year, Mr. Nixon retired involuntarily from the presidency of these United States. He retired to avoid what was certain to be the verdict of guilty rendered by the Senate of the United States on articles of impeachment which had been unanimously voted by the Judiciary Committee of the House of Representatives and would surely have been almost unanimously sustained by the entire House. We learned during 1974 that the wheels of the constitutional process grind slowly. They do work. We saw the result of the long, deliberate, and patient process which began with the discovery of the water break-in, the police courts, the impounding of a grand jury, the selection of prosecutors, the empowering of congressional investigating committees, the selection of a special prosecutor, the defense by the federal courts of the rights of subpoena of this prosecutor's office, the Senate Watergate Committee, Mr. Cox, Mr. Jaworski, the special prosecutors, the House Judiciary Committee, and finally the unanimous decision of our Supreme Court that the president could no longer hide his guilt behind the claims of executive privilege and the confidentiality of his office. He had to release the required documents and the tapes, and these proved him to be a liar. These proved that he had lied to the American people for 2 years, ever since that June day in 1972, when the first news of the Watergate break-in had been brought to him in his office. He had been part of the cover-up conspiracy. He had organized it and managed it. He was trying to see to it that the American people never knew what had happened. But more than the removal of one man from office, a man who was amazingly insensitive to the constitutional process, to what a democracy means, a man who led an administration which suffered from paranoia, which divided Americans into supporters and enemies, More than the removal of this man from office and of his lieutenants, the important thing during 1974 was that in relation to the Watergate incident, American and our elected officials recognized how this administration and some others had abused the regulatory agencies for political purposes, and how some of these agencies had exceeded their stipulated administrative responsibilities. And we are now in a period in which the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the licensing privileges of the Federal Communications Commission and the investigative powers of the Internal Revenue Service and even the sacrosanct intelligence activities of the Central Intelligence Agency are under investigation. Our mails have been opened, our telephones have been tapped, our records have been kept in a variety of ways, illegal ways, and all of this will come out now as the dirty linen will be aired, and new legislation and new controls obviously will be devised. We Americans emerge with a stronger democracy in January of 1975 than we had when we entered last year. But this fact alone is not enough for us to be able to say we can sit back and can be confident of the future. For the state of an economy can very quickly undermine the stablest of constitutional governments. If a government cannot deliver decency, amenity, sufficiency to the community, the mobs take the street and the demagogue leads the mob, and constitutional processes go out of the window. England, during 1974, suffered a worse recession than we knew. Inflation was at twice the level that we endured. We began to read of men organizing private armies, despite England's long constitutional history. The Italian recession, the Italian inflation, was worse than England's. And there were many stories in our newspaper of the private armies of the left and the right clashing openly in the streets. And men were speculating quite openly how long Italy could maintain the image of being a democratic state. We don't have to cast very far back in our own history to remember how Huey Long tried to ride rural poverty into absolute power. And we saw during the 1960s what ghetto poverty could do to the constitutional process. The problems with which President Ford wrestled in his Vail retreat were not only problems of the economy, but they were problems having to do with freedom. For unless the processes, the programs which he devised there were sufficient to bring back some sense of hope and well-being to the nation, it might well be that others would challenge for power, and it might well be that they would not look askance at using illegal means to get into power or to stay there. Now, it's not clear that the urgency of the issue reached the quiet, the elegant calm Vail. So far as there have been leaks to the newspapers, we seem to face a program which will be submitted to the next Congress, which will include the temporary reduction of our taxes, some kind of tariff on imported oil to cut oil consumption, new monies released for federal work projects, and new tax advantages given to business and to the housing industry in order to stimulate them. There will obviously be certain kinds of conservation measures suggested. But beyond that, perhaps beyond the printing of more money, the lowering of the interest rates, beyond that, the administration seems not to be prepared to go. And certainly by private example or in public speech, the administration has not made it clear to Americans, in my estimation, the depth, the seriousness, the problems which we face. There was, during 1974 was the first year in which we had to pay the new quadrupled price for oil. And during 1974, all of the bold plans announced in 1973 for project independence, for new refineries, for the full speed ahead in the development of new technologies for energy, atomic energy, solar energy, water energy, and the like, all these went by the boards. We fell back into the old habit of buying the cheapest oil in the cheapest way possible. We were not even able to devise adequate accounting systems to know where the oil was coming from that we were purchasing. The Brookings Institute during 1974 estimated that the cost of the oil which we imported was the equivalent of sending 1.5 million American jobs abroad. We had not yet begun to pay the full consequence of the oil cartel. And to think of the oil cartel is to recognize that if America is in straitened circumstance, Western Europe and Japan and the poorer nations of the world are in desperate circumstance. If half of our unemployment is in one way or another attributable to the oil embargo, and 1.5 million American jobs were lost, imagine the numbers of jobs which were in jeopardy or lost in England and Italy and Germany and France, Holland, Denmark, and the like. Imagine the economic pressures which face those countries. In point of fact, inflation and recession are today worldwide. And no simple policies designed to cure the ills of the American economy will suffice unless we take into consideration the larger issues and the worldwide international problems. The world is being held up by a small group of states who control, for the moment, the oil reserves of the world. Now, if it were simply a matter of sending our surplus to these countries where it was immediately transformed into a raise in the standards of living for these people, well and good. The Middle East, Venezuela, Nigeria, these are poor countries, have been. The people could be benefited, so much the better. But little of this money is trickling down into human redevelopment. Most of it is sitting there or being reinvested in short-term monies in the markets of the world. The markets are the weaker and the more unstable for them. There seems little ability of these countries, particularly the Arab countries, to ingest the new wealth constructively. And nothing that has somehow come out of Vail suggests that our country or the Western world in consort or the world itself, the consuming nations themselves, have devised some adequate means of coping with this challenge. But even more than the problem of the richness of a few Arab sheikhs, the real problems which confronted our world were the problems not of wealth but of poverty, not of the few but of the many. I don't know if the cries of the poor, the hungry, reached into Vail, but I do know that one of the most significant facts of 1974 was that they began to be heard in the forums of the world. In August of 1974, in Bucharest, a great convention on world population issues was convened by 135 nations. The United States and the Western world brought into this convention a series of very practical proposals. We suggested that the technologically advanced nations share with those not so advanced their birth control know-how, that we invest funds in establishing birth control stations and units here and there, train bureaucrats and doctors and nurses and practitioners in, of the underdeveloped countries, that each country set for itself some quota as it would move towards a condition of population zero. We brought in these proposals. We thought them very generous. Here was some money. Here was some technology. And we were met by ridicule, by anger. India, Bangladesh, sub-Sahara countries, Latin America countries said to us, in fact, you know, the problems do not begin with our numbers. The problems begin with your stomachs. The problem is not that we're spawning like rabbits. The problem is that you're swilling like hogs. The problem is that you're consuming an unconscionable amount of the resource of the world. And you want us to cut back on our numbers simply because you want to be able to continue to live in the hoggish way which has been your way till now. The delegate from Mao Zedong's China went further. He said quite openly that the large population of the Third World is one of their weapons against the imperialism of the free world. What these countries were saying, in point of fact, was that they expect the free world, the rich world, the ex-imperialist world, to cut back on its standard of living, to give of its surplus, to share the wealth, share the diet, and provide for them, that to them our standard of living, that which we take for granted, looks positively obscene. And their anger was heard. It was heard at Bucharest, it was heard in the United Nations. We tended to take very personally as Jews the anger of the Third World because the issue was Palestine, the PLO, and Arafat. In point of fact, much of what was being said there in New York was not so much an attack on Israel per se as it was an attack on Israel as the weakest link in the West. Somehow they could say to Israel's face what could not be said to Washington's face. All the anger spilled out. Now, I hold no brief for Indira Gandhi or Sri Rahman of Bangladesh or many of these other leaders who have been remarkably lackadaisical in the last quarter of a century in providing the necessary population controls in their own countries. They've been remarkably callous to the consequences of their indifference and their inactivity. But I do suggest to you that sheer numbers will weigh heavily on the Western conscience and therefore cause great divisions within a country like America. Between noon of today and noon of tomorrow, 200,000 more mouths will need to be fed in this world. Between January 1 of 1975 and January 1 of 1976, a population equivalent to one-third of the total population of the United States will have come into being on this earth. That many more mouths, 75 million, will need to be fed. And they must be fed. How will they be fed? We've talked about the control of population. The poor countries talk about diet, a new level, much lower level of living for the Western world. And you know, they're poor and underdeveloped. They're not powerless. India, the poorest large nation on the face of this earth. India, which cannot provide 60% of the necessary caloric diet for any of its citizens. India, during 1974, exploded an atomic bomb. It's obvious that we've come to a time where atomic know-how is available to almost any country. And desperation, what have we got to lose, can drive these countries to take a terrible vengeance on the fat world, the rich world, our world. We're going to have to listen. And it's not going to be easy. I guess what I'm saying is that even if the programs devised by Mr. Ford and his associates in Vail are successful in returning America to a prosperity such as we knew a few years ago, even if this were to be, and I don't believe it will be, all we will have achieved is that we will have increased the anger of the rest of the world against us. In November of 1974, a second great international conference was held, a World Food Conference. It was convened in Rome. And all of the problems which will face us in the next decades were very clear. The poor nations, the nations that had suffered the drought in the sub-Sahara, India, Latin America, came to Rome and they demanded immediately 10 million tons of grain from the abundant world, and they demanded half of this from the United States. Now, the United States has become the great greenery of the world. 41% of the crops that we grew last year were shipped overseas. Last year, we shipped no cost some 10 million tons of grain as relief to one part of the world or another. But the United States must pay the new quadrupled price of oil. And the grains that we ship abroad are one of our major, if not now the major, national resource which we have in the sense to exchange for the oil that we import. And when the congressmen and others of our delegation in Rome cabled back to Washington asking us to make an immediate grant of 1 million tons of grain, Washington answered with prudence. There was inflation and recession in the land. We were not sure that we could give that much grain away without serious economic consequence, balance of trade, and the like. And more than this, we were eager to have certain things happen in the world which had not happened heretofore. Why shouldn't the Arab countries, with this newfound wealth which they can't spend, buy our grain and then give it away? Wouldn't that be a wonderful way to recycle the oil profits? Russia and China had not yet agreed to enter into a grain pooling system for the underdeveloped countries of the world. The common market nations, the Argentine and Brazil, had restricted the export of food products. We wanted all of these things to change, and we wanted to use the leverage that we had at Rome in order to achieve this. The poor saw only our denial, and they were encouraged in this by the Arab countries, which did not want to recycle the money in this unprofitable way. The Soviet Union and China, of course, encouraged the anger of the underdeveloped nations. They didn't want to be involved. They had their own problems of harvest, building their economy. And the United States emerged as the evil one, the ungenerous one, the pig. And I'm afraid that's going to be our image in the world for many years to come. Despite our occasional generosities, despite lend-lease, and despite foreign aid and all that these represent, the 10,000 people who die of starvation every week in this world must look on our standard of living, however modest we consider it, as obscene. What's for it then? Obviously, if the leadership of America were to demand too rapid a drop in our standard of living, too fast a drop, there'd be chaos, political chaos in these United States. Our own freedoms would probably go by the board. But surely what is required is a leadership which begins to speak honestly to America of the long-term future, of the need to reorient our objectives, personal and corporate, personal and communal. Surely what is needed in America is a leadership which will talk to us not of further growth and greater prosperity, but will talk to us truthfully of this world, the spaceship Earth, and of its interdependent problems. And we'll not solve all of these problems technologically. Over the last 20 years, American technology, the new fertilizers, the new pesticides, The new high-yield grains have brought about the Green Revolution. It's an American achievement. And the Green Revolution has worked wonders, miracles perhaps. Compared to 20 years ago, 35% more of the Earth's surface is now cultivable, under production. And the yield per acre in our world has been increased by 35%. A truly phenomenal achievement. And the hope in Washington was that the Green Revolution would give the Indias and the Bangladeshes and the sub-Saharan countries of the world time to bring their own populations under control. But they didn't use the time. And so we stand today, 20 years later, not with a population of 2.5 billion people as we had a quarter of a century ago, but with over 3.5 billion people, facing a world which, if it continues to spawn at its present rate, will be a world of 7 billion people by 1990. 10,000 people die every week of starvation. That number has to grow. And we have to get the blame. And we deserve some of the blame. One nutritionist who I've read estimates that the food we consume, we, 210 million of people, every year, would feed 1.5 billion Asians for the same year. We're going to have to tighten our belts and change our diets. But it's not simply a matter of food consumption. It's a matter of energy consumption, of natural resource consumption, of living space consumption, of gluttony. It's a matter of learning to live in a world where the human being has made certain decisions or not made them, which have inevitable consequences. If we were a world of 2 billion people today with population zero, we could look to forward to a time when most people of the world could live as we live today. Our technology could make it possible. But 3.5 billion people growing to 7 billion people cannot live as we live today. Everyone will have to have less who has something now. For those who have nothing now, to have a minimum. These are going to be difficult years, difficult decades. Hard for any country to face a lowering of expectations. We want bigger and better things for our children, if not for ourselves. But I'm afraid that it's not in the cards. Life will be harder, not easier. Living will be more cramped, not more expansive. The problems that we face in our urban life today will be multiplied manyfold. For not only are we adding 200,000 mouths to feed to our world every day, we're adding 1 million illiterates and functional illiterate adults to the world every day. We not only are adding beings, but we're increasing the number of people who cannot operate effectively in an organized social order. Now, what can lighten the gloom? What's the hope at the end of the tunnel? No one has ever proven that happiness is related to wealth. No one has ever shown to my satisfaction that one's net worth determines one's emotional well-being. I know a lot of people who live very modestly, who live very, very well. They are happy, they are fulfilled, they are pleased with what they are doing. They find satisfactions in basic human relationships. They know how to love and how to accept love. They know how to think and how to read a book and how to listen to music and how to look at a picture. They know that you don't have to find your happiness at the far ends of a jet airline. But that's going to require a tremendous transformation of values among all of us. We're going to have to develop community and family. And we're going to have to cultivate our own inner resources much more assiduously than we've ever done before. And in the process of learning to live cooperatively, we're going to have to learn to live with greater numbers and a more egalitarian society, with lines and numbers and cards and patience. It can be done. It will require will and wisdom of a very, very high order. And what disturbs me as we begin 1975 is I hear very few people in power, people whose voices can reach the millions and be listened to, who are saying anything to these American people, to us, except be confident. The first three quarters may be difficult, but the fourth quarter will bring prosperity again. It's only a matter of time. You'll enjoy everything that you've enjoyed before and more so. Hunker down. Soon you'll be able to open up. I simply don't believe it. We have a strong economy. We have a strong nation. We're not going to suffer disaster. But we're going to have to begin now. We want to avoid disaster 10, 20 years from now. All of us. We're going to have to begin now to reorient our lives and our sights, to cultivate a new self, to pay more attention to family and to community, to things which give amenity and decency to life, to change our levels of expectation. How should I end this review of 1974? It was a gray year, but then every year is gray. Someone, some country, some part of the world. The immediate future is not bleak. For a while, we can continue to play, I suspect, the grasshopper's role. There are palliatives which can be suggested to our society. There can be a new level of prosperity for a short period of time. If I were to select a biblical image, I'd select one which I've selected before. It's night, dark night. It's a small walled Judean village. There's a sentry on the wall. A lone passerby in the street, he can't see beyond the mud brick of the wall. He calls up to the sentry, Shomer Mami Laila, Shomer Mami Laila, watchman, what of the night? Watchman, what of the night? The watchman turns from looking at the city to look out across the plain, and he sees the Judean hills, and he sees the first light of the dawn on the hills. He calls back to his friend in the town, Ata boker v'gam laila. The morning comes, but also the night. For each dawn there is a dusk. For each day there is a night. And I hope and pray that as the dawn begins to grow and to lighten the darkness of our economic problems in 1975, we remember that there is a night, black night ahead, unless we use this one further day of prosperity to plan effectively and intelligently major changes in our national and in our private lives.